Well, hello and welcome to the podcast. Above all, there's hope. I'm Mark Johnson.
And I'm Jill Johnson.
And we're here with a very special guest. I'm very excited. We're here with Dr. Carlos Alemany, who is my medical oncologist. So welcome, Dr. Alemany, and thank you so much. I know your time is valuable, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jill. It's a pleasure.
So I guess what I wanted to start off with was I called you my my medical oncologist. What exactly does that mean? What are your responsibilities as my doctor?
Sure. So in every center in the nation or every clinic, the medical oncologist may have a little bit of different role. But in most centers where there is subspecialized care, the medical oncologist tends to be the master of ceremonies of the care of the patient. And they tend to use the other specialties as needed for the care of that patient. So basically, I coordinate your care. I make sure that I'm managing your systemic therapy or treatment that we use to control disease. And then depending on the situation, then use my partners that in other specialties to help out with our patients.
Okay. So I guess you're kind of, at this point, you're the last doctor that I've had on my care team to be added to my care team, and who I call him my primary care urologist, Dr. Steinberg. He was the one that recommended that I contact you, and he said that he would let you kind of quarterback my care from here on out. So I guess that means that you're the one at this point who kind of calls the shots and then lets everybody else know what's going on.
Maybe he's
I can tell you that in the old days, meaning before 15 years ago, mostly it was the urologist managing the care of patients with prostate cancer that had disease beyond the prostate or that required any other therapy just for localized disease. So nowadays, still the urologists are the main caregivers for disease that is localized to the prostate. But once there's either lymph nodes or anything beyond lymph nodes involved with the cancer, then quickly the medical oncologists are invited in the case.
Okay. I guess I have a bunch of questions here. what are some of the top one or two recommendations you would have for people who have prostate cancer? What would you like them to know, in terms of their care? And
sure. So I think that a well-informed patient, to me, is very, very important. So I always educate the patients on their diagnosis, on their staging, where the disease is, what are the therapies available, what are the risk factors that got you to this point, if there's any. Unfortunately, sometimes we don't find any risk factors, and it's one of those things that you say, well, I did everything right and still got prostate cancer. It's possible. So I try to educate as much as possible the patient, because when the patient understands how things evolve and how things work, they can participate in their care much better, and they are part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Right. Okay. So we know that, at least I know that even as I've been dealing with this this journey for the past bit over 10 years, I know that even that time there have been many advancements in the treatment of prostate cancer. Can you tell us what some of those advancements that have stood out, which you'd like, have stood out to you?
Right. So I think that it has not been more exciting than in the last 10 years to practice what I do for a living. I can tell you that when I graduated from my fellowship in the early 2000s. We had probably around 25, 30 drugs at the most to treat all types of cancer, which sounds like a lot of drugs, but right now we have well over 200 drugs. So things have really changed significantly. For prostate cancer specifically, we went from a therapy that was mainly based on something called bicalutamide, which is one of the earlier oral agents for prostate cancer, to Leuprolide or Lupron and other similar agents like Eligard, et cetera, which were basically the mainstay of a treatment until the early 2000s when chemotherapy started to become more important. And then in the decades between 2010 and 2020, a flurry of different agents were approved by the FDA to treat not only the receptor where testosterone attaches to, which is the main driver of most prostate cancers, but also other agents that actually help stimulate the immune system, other chemotherapy agents, and more recently, radiopharmaceuticals that tend to attach to the prostate cancer cells if they have overexpression of something called PSMA. So again, we have gone through a lot of different therapies over the last 10 years, and it's just getting better every single year.
I know that as I was, when I was first introduced to you you became part of my journey. And at that point we were just kind of monitoring my PSA. And one of the things that you said to me was, and I asked you, you know, as my PSA was slowly rising, I asked you, well, when will we know that what next steps to be? And you said, well, we have a few things kind of, you know, standing in the wings, ready to go. And when we know, we'll know. And then at the start of next year was when my PSA jumped. And then at that point, you started me on Lupron and Erleada. It's kind of amazing where you have all of these things kind of standing at the ready for the next phase, the next turn. Correct. In the journey. So,
and you know what? One thing that I think is very important when you are getting your treatment for whatever disease in oncology, the person needs to go to a center where they have not only standard therapies available, but ideally that center should also have clinical trials available in case that the patient would qualify for something like that, or unfortunately the patient has gone through all the therapies possible. So we need to have a fallback, and that usually will be clinical trials. Our center is blessed that we have a phase one clinical trials program, which is something that very few centers in the nation have. So we are in a special group of centers that actually are able to continue taking care of patients when we run out of basic treatments or basic modalities.
Right. I remember when we made the move to Erleada and Lupron, you also tried to enroll me for a clinical trial, but I was found that I was not eligible for that particular one.
Right.
But that's a good thing, because that helps people, give them hope and you know, continue on their journeys.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Jill, did you have any questions?
So I have a couple of questions, yeah. I think you had told us that Thursday was your research and study day, and so I'm curious about future treatments, advancements that are on the horizon, and I know this is a pretty common question. Do you think there will ever be a cure for cancer?
So I think the short answer to your question is yes. I think that eventually we're going to hit a way to cure most cancers. Every cancer is different to the next one. And every person with, for example, talking about prostate cancer, every person with prostate cancer is different to the next one. And what I mean by that is that obviously every person will have different genetics, different medical problems, different medications, different habits, different ages. So all of those things are taken into consideration when I treat a patient and when we treat patients. So I think that a cure might be possible for, let's say, if we have 10 patients in a row, you might be able to cure 7 of those patients right now. But then you have 3 that unfortunately have a relapse of the disease. And those 3, from those 3, perhaps 2 of them may do very well with drug number A, and then the other one may not, and actually may do better with drug C. So every single patient will have a little bit different situation. So that's why when I explain to patients what they have, I also tell them, listen, every person that I treat is different to the next one. And even though you might read in the literature or in Google or in your search engine that patients have A, B, and C as the treatment options, that A, B, C may not be the choices for you. Or, yeah, that might be actually exactly what we need to do for you. So it's not straightforward. So we basically personalize the care for every single one of our patients.
So, at this point, I remember when we first met, and this is more of a comment than a question. I remember that when I had my first appointment with you, you said that we would be friends for a long time. And that gave me hope, and that stuck with me. Obviously, I'm saying this, you know, a couple of years later. I know that every time I go into your building there, I see people going in and out of your office and in and out of the building, and it's a cancer center, so. In some way, shape, or form, everybody that goes in and out of that building is living with or dealing with cancer in some way.
Yeah, impacted in some way.
Yeah, but what I want to know, how do you, I think you have one of the best bedside manners of many, many doctors. It's a very, you're always very positive and you're always very upbeat. You know, sometimes in the face of potential heartbreak for families or patients, what gives you hope?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Mark. I think that, you know, every one of us will deal with situations like the ones that we deal every day a little bit differently, but in general, most oncologists that know what's out there, they are very hopeful because they know that they're still able to help patients in so many different ways. And sometimes actually it's not about a drug, it's about helping them understand their disease so that they can plan for the future. You know, there's so many different situations, but personally, I take great comfort in my faith. I'm a Christian. Every person, every physician in my practice may have a different faith, but that doesn't mean that they do not have hope. So again, we all have different ways on how we stay upbeat and ready to fight for every single one of our patients. But I think that for me personally, it would be my faith. Second would be the fact that I know what's out there and I know that we can help so many people. And again, because of the possibility of enrolling patients into our clinical trials, I know that when we run out of the typical options, I still have different options that I can offer my patients to help them out.
Thank you. That's those are great words of reassurance. I think not only to me but to people who would be listening to this podcast. So I, one of the things that in some of the earlier podcasts, in some of the earlier episodes, we've talked about how prostate cancer is more predominant in Black men. Is it known why that happens?
It is not completely understood, but there is a genetic link there. Prostate cancer is actually one of the most inherited or linked to inheritance cancers out there. Everybody thinks of breast cancer and the famous BRCA mutation or BRCA. Well, guess what? The same mutation can be found in prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. It's actually the most common mutation in prostate cancer. So So when I meet a patient for the first time, I always ask them in detail their family history, because I need to know or at least have an idea if this cancer came from a mutation that you inherited, or is it just sporadic, or some other possibility. So yes, genetics play a large playing in our what we do. We have drugs now that we can use for patients that have specific mutations. So it is something that is not just information; it's actually actionable information.
Okay, that's this is a very reassuring podcast, I think, today. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy for that. There was another question.
And I wanted to mention also that, you know, interestingly, for the issue
Dr.
of African American,
do you have any final thoughts that you would like to strongly convey to our audience?
Yes. So let me just finish the thought about the African American population, because historically, African American patients, not just prostate cancer, but pretty much in all cancers, they have not received the same type of care compared to Caucasians or other ethnic groups. And I think that gap has been closing, thankfully, year by year, but there's still some work to do. So unfortunately, a lot of prostate cancer patients that are African American come to us a little bit too late in regards that we cannot do surgery or we cannot do radiation to control the disease locally 100% and cure them. So a lot of patients actually coming a little bit late, either because they don't go to the physician often or for whatever reason they're not getting the proper medical care. But certainly, if there's any African-American person out there that does not have prostate cancer, or at least have a family member with prostate cancer, they need to be checked 10 years sooner than the typical Caucasian patient for prostate cancer. So what that means, the guidelines right now for Caucasians and for most patients with lower risk for developing prostate cancer is that they start screening at age 50 with a digital rectal exam and a PSA. And even that, a few years ago, was actually the motive of controversy when a large task force came out with recommendations not to be checking PSAs for everybody out there, which I think was a disturbance, because unfortunately what happened over the last 10 years is that a lot of patients actually are getting diagnosed late. So just to give a little background on that, about 25, 30 years ago when PSA was invented, PSA was invented to monitor patients with advanced prostate cancer, or to monitor patients that actually had surgery or radiation to the prostate and were cured, and then we were monitored to see if there was any evidence of relapse. What has happened over the last 30 years is that PSA, because that was the only real laboratory that we had, was utilized to diagnose prostate cancer. But unfortunately, it doesn't diagnose 100% of patients, meaning that you can have a normal PSA and still have prostate cancer. Mm. So the inventor of the PSA years ago said that he was so sad that the PSA was used for what is used right now, which is to diagnose patients. Mm. But at the same time, he understood that that was the only good test that we had at the moment, but it was not meant for that reason. So again, going back to the issue of African Americans, I think that they need to be checked 10 years before the rest of the population. That means that starting at age 40, but if that African-American person has a family member that was diagnosed at age 42, guess what? You need to start checking yourself at age 32. Right. So it's 10 years to your family member, or 10 years on the average patient, which would be age 40.
Wow. Yikes. It's kind of unsettling, but that's really good information to know.
Sure.
A couple other thoughts, and then we'll let you go. And again, thank you so much. One of them is, do you have any thoughts as to why prostate cancer flies under the radar so much, you know, especially as compared to, say, something like breast cancer, and why it's just so difficult to get awareness out there? I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that it is still the number one cancer in males. So definitely it's not a rare situation. It's actually a very common situation. That's number one. Number two is, for comparing it to breast cancer, which is the number one cancer in ladies. Breast cancer is located in an area of the body that is accessible. So it's in the breast. So many times actually ladies will feel it. In prostate cancer, typically gentlemen do not feel it. Now, typically the reason why a lot of gentlemen get diagnosed is because they start having urinary symptoms. And when they do, they go and see the doctor, not thinking of prostate cancer, and thinking that, you know what, I'm getting old and maybe things are not working out the same. But unfortunately, they do have prostate cancer. The other reason why gentlemen get also checked out is because of erectile dysfunction. Everything was working well. All of a sudden, you are 55 and things are not working well. What happened? So that could be the prompting issue. And that person may never have had a PSA. That patient may never have had a digital rectal exam. So again, it's one of those things that that it might be another reason why the person goes to get checked out and it turns out that it's prostate cancer. Mm. Also, in regards to breast cancer, it is the number one cancer for ladies, and ladies typically still, and they will always be, the center of the family. So when you have the center of the family being affected, then obviously everybody's on board, everybody's trying to help out. The average age for breast cancer is around 60. The average age for patients with prostate cancer is a little bit older, say 65 to 70. So that means that there's always some outliers where patients can get diagnosed in their 50s or 40s or even sooner than that. Right. But it's actually an outlier. Most of the patients actually are in their late 60s or 70s when they get diagnosed with prostate cancer. Breast cancer, when it affects a lady in let's say in their 40s or 50s, they're still a vital part of their family, taking care of either children or grandchildren, which impacts the family. So obviously the stress on the family may be more in a situation of breast cancer compared to prostate cancer. But again, it all depends on the age when that patient gets diagnosed.
Okay. I was diagnosed at about 55, and mm-hmm. Dr. Patel, who did my surgery, said, you know, based on what he could see, I had probably had it since I was like 45 or something. But it's quite a thing. One of the things that I'm finding out is the cost of medications to cover to help deal with this is quite high.
It is.
How are doctors helping to get these costs down?
So unfortunately, we do not have much say in the situation. I used to, because they don't invite me anymore. I used to attend these advisory boards where they ask opinions of the doctors, you know, the pharma companies. And always my last question, I would be always the last one standing and say, okay, so question for you guys, why do you guys charge so much for your drug? So obviously, when you have a room full of doctors that were all eager to prescribe a physician, whatever drug they were not promoting, but at least were talking about that day, and then the last person asks that question, and it comes out that the drug is $10,000 per month, and you're like, wow, $10,000, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So obviously, everybody puts the brakes, so they don't invite me to those anymore. But the truth is that is actually something that we all have in our minds. We are sickened by the prices of the drugs in this country. We pay basically for all the research and development of all these drugs. And many of these drugs actually start in an NCI-sponsored National Cancer Institute laboratory. And then these pharma companies, they take these drugs and they finalize the development. And they're giving it to them for nothing, and they make billions of dollars out of them. So
yeah.
It doesn't sound fair that we have to be the country in the world that pays the most to get these drugs when we are the ones that actually do the clinical trials. We go through all this research and development, and it's paid by taxpayer dollars many times.
Yeah.
So it is truly a major problem. So I think that's a great question to pose to our congressman, because I think that eventually, unless Congress really tighten up the bolts on pharma to start actually becoming more feasible for us to buy drugs that are much cheaper, this is not going to change. And unfortunately, I don't see that changing for a while.
Okay, that's write your I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing. Write your congressman.
Yes, I know. Me too, because it's very troubled. And as you can see, our government works really well. So let us good luck with that one.
Oh, jeez, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, did you have any, and again, I am so grateful and thankful for your time. Did you have any final thoughts or things that you wanted
to share?
Yeah, sure.
I can tell you that. Number one, I want to thank you guys for the invitation. I want to commend you and your wife for this beautiful podcast. I think that this really will help a lot of people long term. I think that typically guys do not talk much about their problems compared to ladies. If you look at breast cancer podcasts or breast cancer support groups, there's a million of them. If you look at prostate cancer, there's not too many of them.
Right.
So what you guys are doing is something really amazing. For the patients out there hearing us today, don't lose hope. There's a lot of things out there. I think it's important to always have your affairs in order, regardless of how well you're doing with your cancer. I think that's always something that I tell my patients, listen, make sure you have your affairs in order, not because you're going to think that you're going to die tomorrow. It's because you need to have your affairs in order. And unfortunately, depending on what you have done with your life, a lot of people do not plan on those things.
Right.
And eventually, all of us eventually will die. So we have to be, like my father used to say, and he unfortunately died with lung cancer. He used to say, we need to make sure we die healthy, meaning that you have taken care of your family, you have taken care of everything you can. And then when it's time to go, the good Lord will take us. And you know what? It's going to be all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are good words. So typically what we do is we give Jill the last word in this podcast because, well, she's...
A woman.
She's the boss.
Yes, she is.
I always
regardless
word.
Of where you or I stand, she is That's the boss. Right. So
you're a smart man.
Well, I'll say this. I am not the boss. But, for the last word, I always get the last word because I'm the person with all the words. So oftentimes the last word is men. Get yourself checked. And as Dr. Alamany said today, if you're having any problems performing sexually, or if he didn't say it that way, or if you're having difficulty with your urinary flow, these could be warning signs of prostate cancer. And it's very scary to step out and say, oh boy, maybe I better go get checked. But go get checked. The earlier you get checked, the better your chances. So that's my last word for today.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree 100%.
So the next episode that we have is what I've titled, Who You Gonna Call? And that's going to cover how do you pick your care. And one of the things that I have said for quite a while in this, even before this podcast, and it's the words that we use to end the episode, because people who are struggling with cancer, I like to say I'm living with cancer, but I know that there are many, many people out there who are struggling with it, and it's a challenge, and so I always just like to say, be strong and persevere. So, Dr. Alamany, I'm really, really thankful for you doing this for us today, with us today.
Absolutely. So. And I would say my last word would be, above all, there is hope.
Oh, yeah. That's a good word.
That's a good one. Thank you so much.
I heard about it. I don't know where.
Yeah.
I would like to say one more thing, too. Be strong and persevere because the Lord is with you. And I always like to invite you to comment on our web page, ask for prayer. We'll be glad to pray for you. We believe that God is a healer.
I think that that's something that we as physicians do not ask for often enough, but I would say that please do pray for all of us.
Thank you. Thank we you. Will.
Yeah. And thank you so much again.
Yeah, thanks.
God bless, guys. Good to talk to you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.